Let's get started on rummaging, which we're going to actually expand a little bit out to data mining because that's more fun anyways. And I'm Chris Hoffines. I am a trial attorney at a firm here in Atlanta called Casey Gilson. And
you are?
I'm Paul Toppins. I'm an attorney in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I want to say it's a great honor to be sitting next to the undisputed expert on data mining and rummaging in the Southeast. So I'm just going to just listen all day long, all morning long. Kidding, actually. We actually had a discussion yesterday about what did Scott mean by rummaging? Do you have an idea what he was talking about? And we thought, well, we'll just focus on data mining. I see now from the side outside, I may have, you know, I was focusing on some of the other panels that he assigned us to. But now I understand what he was looking at. And I
especially since I decided to promote something on Facebook this year, and so I signed up for Facebook and I saw it was recommending friends, and I did not allow Facebook to go through my inbox and look at my emails, but I saw I saw friend recommendations from all these people that I had emailed in the past, and how did it possibly ever get all these emails? And of course, these are people that they agreed to let Facebook scan their email inbox, and they had emailed me, and so it remembered, even though it is not keeping the password, it remembered that, you know, all the email addresses. So that was an interesting eye-opener.
Well, and the question I would raise is, do they really agree, or do they just not realize they were agreeing? Because I suspect a lot of them may not. I've never used Facebook other than to spy on other people,
no,
which I do
that
quite frequently.
That's great.
But I was surprised when Google, for Gmail, all of a sudden, when they came out with, and I can't remember the name of, what was their competitor to, they're trying to set up, Buzz. All of a sudden, I began reading that they're going to turn on Buzz, and all of your contacts and all of your things are going to suddenly appear on your Buzz page that they're setting up for you. And it was like, whoa, how do I stop that? I don't really want to have all my phone numbers displayed over the internet, because then they're out there. So that's my first experience with rummaging. But
I'm going to digress. I just have to tell a story. You know, trial attorneys, people sue for personal injury, saying, "Hey, I threw my back out. I can't work. You know, I basically can't move." And then you go on their Facebook page, and they have pictures of them water skiing last weekend. So much fun. But that's now a standard operating procedure for us, is we'll do a bankruptcy search, and we'll hunt for you and see if we can find something where you're lying to us, if you're ever in litigation. But
while he's reading his notes, I think there's a generational difference on concern about that. I was talking to our pet sitter this weekend, college kid. Nice girl, but I did a Google search on her when I, you know, hired her. Just want to find out if she'd ever been arrested for animal cruelty or, you know, having DUIs or anything like that. And discovered that she, you know, had a Twitter page. And it got to be addictive to me. I read that girl's Twitter page all the time. And I'm just amazed at the things that people will disclose about themselves. You know, you get a feel. I'd love to be an anthropology, you know, doctoral student and go and look at just things that are posted online to try to craft a description of people or of communities. But anyway, I was talking to her about it, and she said, "Nah, you know, it's out there. You know, I don't worry about it. You know, I'm sort of like my life's an open book." And to me, with my advancing years, I think that's a product of youth, where you don't realize, you don't have the experience or the perspective to suddenly regret, you know, to realize you're going to regret suddenly, or not suddenly, you're going to regret somewhere down the road, all of these things being displayed when, you know, just for any Yahoo to look at. Anyway, that's digression. Now you can
digressing. No, I think the issue here is the moral and ethical and cultural expectation of privacy versus the true legal expectation of privacy, or the privacy rules in the agreements that you sign. I mean, how many of y'all actually read a EULA or a terms of service or a term?
All our business. I
read the business ones.
Okay.
But why is what I want to know.
Always.
Always. I have a question. Ever. I stopped reading them because I wanted to get to that site, and that's the only way to get here. There's no negotiation. I can't pick up a phone and say, hey, guys, instead of, you know, it's all or nothing. So
I scan for super egregious terms. When I read, it's basically all I'm doing.
Okay. Keith, you read everything because you're paranoid or because it's part of your job or why?
Being an ex-spook, yeah, I read everything. The other thing is that since I'm into information security, people come to me and ask me questions about stuff. Is that okay? Is that safe? And, well, they expect me to know the highlights reel of bad stuff about it. So I read everything. I read all the license agreements. I read all that stuff because they expect me to essentially make a ruling on whether it's bad.
I don't read it because I depend on people like you. I sort of depend on the cloud, or if that's the right word to use, to tell me, to notify me of things that might be I need to be cautious about. You know, so I don't sign up for some things as much as I might want to get on there and see. Like, I've never signed up for Facebook just because I don't want to figure out how to turn off all the things that. That's why I'm one of the people talking about Facebook tomorrow, I guess. I've never used it other than to spy on people.
Yeah, but the point I was going to make is that, you know, there can be anything in those EULAs. I don't remember who it was. Over April Fool's, 200 or 300 people signed away their soul. It's not enforceable, unfortunately. But so when Facebook says I'm gonna enable this feature, and yay, I'm gonna enable it for everybody, you have to go turn it off. As a culture, we go, what the is wrong with you? But legally, they're great. That's part of their agreement. They can do that. But one of the things I've noticed is a whole lot of pushback, at least against Facebook doing that, which is the culture, I think, correcting them finally. What do you think about that, Paul?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, that is using the crowd to the consensus of the crowd are the ones ringing the bells to get them to pull back on it. I mean, Google did the same thing with their Buzz. They got such heat in the press and in the technical press about it that they turned it off. It wasn't on by default, or it wouldn't load all your contacts on.
But Facebook actually got a CNN story on it, which, I mean,
yeah.
CNN doesn't have great market share anymore, but still, it's mainstream.
I what I'm waiting for, and I think it'll take a different change in the court system a bit. The judges skew one particular political persuasion or another for a while, depending on how they were appointed. The federal judges, talking about the federal system, and it hasn't skewed back to the left yet. And I'm not actually sure the left is the way to go. Because it's more of a libertarian thing. And no telling sometimes where that comes down, whether it's on the right or the left, that you'll find support for it. But there's a theory in law called adhesion contracts, where you have no choice about negotiating the terms. It's take it or leave it. And adhesion contracts always come with an imbalance in bargaining power. One side's got all the power, or all the power, depending on how it's weighted, and the other side has none. And so, at least in law school, they taught that you know, if it's an adhesion contract and it has unconscionable terms, you can't be bound by those, or you can escape from those.
Basically, if the powerful party takes advantage too much of the not powerful party.
And I'm just waiting for somebody I'm sure they've tried it, but it hasn't caught hold. Somebody to come along and say, some court to come along and be supported by other courts. That some of the provisions in a EULA, for example, are unconscionable, and we just can't allow them. Now, the other alternative is you have legislation that would say that you can't do that. I mean, Europe, for example, has very stringent privacy laws against corporations, against businesses. They're very open. I mean, the government can do all sorts of things in Europe that the government supposedly can't do here, is not supposed to do here. But we have the flip side. You know, if it's an agreement, you know, if you basically consented to it, then you can do all sorts of things. And I'm waiting, you know, depending on politics, and it may not come anytime soon, there may be legislation that says, you know, you cannot collect information and you cannot disclose information, you cannot require these terms.
Or at least a disclosure requirement, like with lemon laws, for example.
And the the thing that the big bugaboo, maybe I don't know if you're a defense trial attorney or a plaintiff's trial attorney.
A little bit of both.
The big bugaboo for lawyers is the arbitration clauses. That change in the politics suddenly took a 1930s, I think, provision of the federal code that said arbitration is permissible in some circumstances. It took for the Supreme Court not too long ago, 20 years maybe, to say, well, my gosh, you know, if they have an arbitration clause, it has to be enforced. Because a lot of states had provisions that said you cannot force someone to end arbitration. You can't take away their right to go to court. Well, because of a change in the Supreme Court's makeup, that was changed. That was interpreted differently. And the Supreme Court suddenly said, no, you got to enforce arbitration. You can't have these state laws that are all struck down. You can't prohibit arbitration. Because of this law that came about in the 1930s that had been sitting on the books and used basically in labor contexts or a securities context. I'm waiting for that to change. I'm waiting for somebody to come along at a national level and say, you can't force someone to arbitrate because they're all in adhesion contracts. Every arbitration clause you've got is, you know, you buy a car. You can't buy a car anywhere anymore unless you agree to arbitrate. And as a lawyer, and I've done the defense side, so I'm really speaking against interest. I mean, I've represented businesses, but I know that you just don't get the same rights, and the rights aren't protected the same way in arbitration as they are potentially if you could take it to court. There's no the biggest problem I have arbitration, you go to arbitration and whatever the arbitrator decides, there's really no good way to get somebody else to look at that and determine that it was done fairly or correctly or based on the law. But that's my little rant. I'm sorry.
What specific EULA terms do you think are likely to get struck down as unconscionable, like common ones?
None right now. None.
It does depend on the legislative structure that would be created by Congress, or I guess the courts, saying, you know, what your privacy rights in electronic information are. The other interesting thing, the other wrinkle on this is, what's your reasonable expectation of privacy when you have deliberately given data to a third party? And I mean, on the one hand, you are this is explicit Supreme Court precedent. You know, you're running the risk that this third party is going to give to somebody else, and you know that's tough. On the other hand, you know, I go to Facebook and I have an entire scheme set up of, you know, my friends can see these, my friends of friends can see this, nobody can see this except my wife. And when Facebook then just screw it, blows that off. Am I truly running that risk when I give them the data, when there's an agreement between us, at least by the way the settings are, on how they're going to treat my data? So it's a kind of a wiggly area, unfortunately, right now.
I'm at work at a university in InfoSec, for those who don't know, and I get requests periodically from students that have since graduated, could you please take down that web page? I found it on Google and I don't want my boss to see that. And mm-hmm. I say, sure, we'll take it down immediately. We, you know, 10 minutes later, the site's down. And I send them a polite email that says, we took the site down, just be aware that there's archives of this everywhere. You don't know who copied it locally. That image is going to show up everywhere. Consider it out there permanently.
Yeah.
Don't realize that. And that same attitude goes to Facebook. That they post stuff on Facebook that gets them fired from jobs. They do very silly things.
Yeah, for the first 3 years out of college, one of the top 20 results for me was an old Babylon 5 argument about CGI settings that site had shut down, but somebody had repeated it in their own personal manifesto, and I'm not going to make a comment about that person. And I'm just sitting here going, well, it's not like a complete idiot. I guess I'll just leave it there. But yeah, nothing ever goes away on the internet.
Yeah, I try to minimize my online presence. This is now, I guess. I mean, I thought seriously what I said. I'd be willing to talk at DragonCon. Oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to suddenly have a DragonCon. You know, well, okay, I guess that's all right. I can live with that, as long as I don't do anything stupid. But I post to a number of different boards, but I use, you know, screen names. And I'm waiting because I've had to use screen names with a Yahoo account that I don't, you know, I only get commercial mail at. You know, if they ask for your email address, I use that account. And I'm waiting because I've used that address to order things, you know, products online. I'm waiting for that information to get together with who I am. And then all of a sudden, my name and my screen name that I used for all these things, and I try to keep my online, even those I try to keep toned down. I don't want to, you know,
embarrassing.
Yeah, right. But I'm waiting because I know it's going to happen. Every time I use it or use that Yahoo account as the address for something that requires my real name or my credit card, you know, I order something, my address. I think, you know, here's another piece I'm giving to them, another little link. Going to let them, you know, connect those two. And then all of a sudden, you'll be able to read everything that I might say about, you know, cell phones. I have a get on Howard forums a lot and talk about phones because I love cell phones. It's the new computer stuff as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
I'm working on software to put the two together based on your writing style.
Well, I think that's cool. I've seen the in the Primary Colors book that was published after Clinton. Bill Clinton's second election?
First
election, okay.
By
Anonymous,
right. Yeah.
They made it into a movie, John Travolta. But the guy who wrote it was a columnist for Newsweek, but it was published by Anonymous. And somebody, I think, at a university ran a program that compared writing styles. So I figured this guy's got to be, you know, like a political reporter or something, and identified him as the person who likely wrote that book, and he fessed up and said, "Yeah, I wrote the book." I mean, I'm waiting for. I don't think that day is far off where they can, getting back to our topic, they can do, you know, some data mining. They can look at not only the information that you've got posted, but what you've said, and begin to piece together things about who you are. You have
to get the mic back to the back in the corner.
Back here. What do you guys think about 4chan and its ability to track down people, and how can you prevent that?
Sorry, distracted by 4chan. my wife's gonna be bad at that joke. I don't know how they do this. This is my problem. I don't have the data. How do they track people?
I've heard of 4chan, but I'll be honest, I haven't. That's about all I've done. I've heard about it.
Bob, good for you. It's a manual process.
Yeah.
Not very reliable. There's a lot of people who are.
Do they chase down your IP and then try and figure out who you are?
Well, they basically find pictures and look at people, and a lot of times they'll get the wrong person, and they'll end up ruining someone's life.
So someone will post a picture and
say,
"Yeah,
it's like, well, you
this?
Look like this person," and then they post it, and it's done.
Yeah.
And that's it for them.
Oh. Okay.
Well, I mean, the
it's on.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they'll do a lot of IP hunting, and it's a lot of manual process there, from what I understood.
In preparing for today, I was reading an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, but it was talking about a company called X Plus One. It's an advertising company, I guess an advertising company, but they can take, and it was explaining how they work with Capital One. You go to the Capital One website, and Capital One, the software, looks at things that are disclosed just by your going to the website. What your ISP is, you know, what your IP address is, where you're located, which is, you know, surely I assume everybody in this room knows that if you go any place, your IP address, they probably can figure out where you're connecting, what city you're in. So they get your zip code. And then they do some other things, some other calculations, from things that are just readily available that are transmitted as part of the process, not without having to go beyond and snoop a little. And it tailors the kind of advertisements you see. So if you're in a zip code that's affluent, they're going to send you a different kind of ad. But I mean, they do it even more. Break it down. By trying to get your age and
I'll log on to a Minnesota-based political site, and I'm getting ads for Roy Barnes, who is, you know, the Georgia gubernatorial candidate, and I don't think he's doing anything in Minnesota, but they're playing with that. I'm going to be a little contrarian now because it's fun, and talk about some of the benefits of allowing rummaging.
I actually have a question that's kind of related to that, because as an example, there's some backstory. I'm on a internet forum for metal shapers, people who take sheet steel and beat it until it looks like a car.
Yeah.
And in there, everyone deals first names, last names. Everyone knows who each other are. It's a very, very polite place. Very seldom end up in arguments, and they're quickly resolved. And what is the cost for people to know, you know, do I care if people know that I beat metal into cars? So with that, with the slight advantage there of not having anonymity, and then a separate incident that may be illustrative of this is I was sitting in traffic one day, and I saw an attractive young lady sitting in her convertible with a vanity plate and a plate frame that was a local women's sports team. And very quickly, when I got to work, I thought, I wonder if that's really as dumb as I think it is. So I did some quick searches, and within about a half hour, I knew where she lived, I knew where she worked. I knew what her last house had sold for and where it was. And just going off of a vanity plate and her association with a sports team. So, yeah. I mean, really, if you're controlling your information on the internet to some extent, but in real life, it's not protected.
I was reading this article on how to preserve his anonymity, there we go, so people can't track him by his license plate. Steve Jobs simply doesn't have a license plate, and apparently hasn't gotten a ticket for it yet, but...
It's just that car without the license plate. That's Steve Jobs.
Yeah. In the handicap spot, usually. Yeah.
I work with a credit agency.
You guys want this to go on?
Oh, okay. Sorry. All right.
We know everything.
Yeah.
We know because 20 years ago you signed up for a cruise somewhere. We know all your basic information. We watched every piece of data on you. We got a piece of data that's sitting out there by itself. They'll find a way to match it up with the correct data.
Yeah.
These guys are crazy when it comes to modeling. You know, predictive analytics. We work with companies to decide on what's the best product to offer based on your previous purchases. It's a little scary, but it's also really cool.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff is all provided by the person. You know, they filled out a card that's signed up on a website, and it's all completely legal. It's all transparent because you've given that information.
But when you gave that information, you didn't intend for it to be connected to everything else. That's the...
What most people don't realize is this car, even though you're signing up for this cruise,
right,
it's part of a large corporation, and they get to sell that data off and stuff. And it's all above board, but it's the data that you've filled out ever since you were a little kid, you probably haven't on.
One of the cases I'm working on, we're trying to collect from a guy who's not paying a judgment. And you know, he's a businessman. He's doing some transactions, but not a whole lot. And we pulled down a Lexus dossier on him that was 129 pages of just, you know, every previous house, previous address, his phone numbers, businesses he's been associated with. I mean, everything. And it, you know, we found this guy in about 5 minutes, and he was trying to not be available for service. But I was kind of going to talk about maybe some of the benefits and why it might be a good idea to allow rummaging. And talking about identity, the redundancy effect. In other words, if they're connected to... Oh, do you have a question? Okay.
I was just going to say, I think his points kind of illustrated what I was getting at is...
If someone can pull up everything about you from something as simple as a poorly chosen plate frame, is it really worth protecting the fact that you're a beekeeper?
Well, the problem I have with it, before we get to the benefits, and it goes against my libertarian nature on some things, is the fear, you know, if they want to sell me something, And they, all it uses that information to tailor to give me an ad that I'm probably going to be somewhat interested in based on their statistics. That's okay. I don't mind it. I can just ignore it if I'm not interested. Or maybe something, I would like to explore that further. I get. The part that scares me a little bit is if they can create all these profiles, when they can, on all this information that's out there, and it's out there, you can't do anything about it. You know, we could start over again. My daughter is 14; it's too late. She's already been online, and you know, probably answered some of those little online questionnaires that test your IQ and crap, you know, stuff like that. That gives all sorts of data. She didn't know any better, and despite what we told her. What I'm worried about is in the wrong hands. If they suddenly decide, you know. And it goes to the paranoid kind of fear that you know, some groups have. They decide that, you know, people that go to Dragon Con, you know, they really probably need to be watched more closely because they're going to be anti-authoritarian maybe, or they, you know, whatever they decide. So they go and they find, you know, people that have, you know, paid for their Dragon Con tickets with a credit card. You know, because that information, gosh, all the credit card information that's out there, that's amazing, you know, that you can put together and create profiles. That's the part that I worry about a little bit. I mean, there's nothing, it hasn't happened, but it's as far as I know.
What, you mean the FBI has never done that in the past to groups they kind of wanted to keep an eye on? That's never happened, huh?
No, well, if I get back. Certainly they haven't had they've done it in the past. But the ability to do it, and to do it really well, and do it really thoroughly, is only increasing as time goes by.
I mean, if they have somebody that is, you know, a subversive, and then they're tracking that guy's credit cards, and all of a sudden they're seeing the 10 people who also bought food at that restaurant within 10 minutes, and they correlate that over about a month and a half, and all of a sudden they know who every one of that person's friends are, and you just may like Chinese food. And you both live near this, but so there's a real issue of one, things that you truly are not putting out there, but also there's just the issue of error rates and the ease of correlation now. You know, it's one thing to send in somebody into the group and take names and compile a dossier, and it's another thing when they can just pull information 24/7 and just suck it all in and compile it.
And treat it as gospel.
Treat it as being correct, because the supposition about what this means, treat that as a fact.
And I was just thinking about DNA evidence and how DNA evidence can be misused because it's so trustworthy, quote unquote. And in some circumstances, it really isn't. It's a 1 in 6 chance in some tests, but it's DNA. Well, you know, what if it's a correlation sample? You know, in 20 years, judges may say, well, it's a correlation sample. It must be right. It's right 90% of the time. And if you're in the 10%, oops.
You know, I'm sure that the stuff is going on right now trying to track terrorists, but they're obviously not doing a very good job of it, or it isn't absolute, because they aren't tracking all the terrorists. We are, you know, the people sitting next to them on the plane are catching them, or. But that's where it's going to come when and I'm not worried about corporations so much. I'm worried about government when they discover that they can do all this data mining and create profiles of everybody in the country, you know, and if doing so helps them maybe identify people who they need to watch more closely, you know, that's going to happen.
That happened with Saddam Hussein. In the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, we had a very complete map of his network of government people, but a woefully incomplete map of his network of his tribal connections from his hometown. And so when we invaded and overthrew the government, he just shifted networks, and we had no clue where he was for however long it was. So we sat there and went, oh, and started building tribal network maps and found him fairly quickly. So we're already doing it, at least to some limited extent.
In light of the discussion about contracts of adhesion and the fact that the credit reporting bureaus, Equifax being a big one here in town, basically collecting data because of third-party contracts, to have a bank account, all these things, you're not really having a choice to agree that your information is being compiled into a massive database of information sharing.
You may agree to allow them to share it.
With your business partner.
But you have no choice but to agree to allow. The option is don't have a cell phone, don't have a bank account. The opposite is so basically makes it impossible to exist.
Which means the groups that do that are terrorists. They've learned to do everything in cash.
Yeah, the
But that now is a trigger. You go buy a plane ticket in cash. Ding 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 ding. And bells go off.
And it's my understanding.
Unless you're supposed to go off, right? Yeah.
And it's my understanding that the government is not allowed to itself collect a lot of this information because of constitutional protections. But then they can go and buy the reports from the privately compiled groups. So
I'm sure they're a giant customer of Equifax and TransUnion, if TransUnion still exists.
We need a second mic, maybe.
And government and military require you to use direct deposit, so you have to go with a bank. Mm-hmm. So that information absolutely has to, you don't have the option of saying, no, pay me a check and I'll cash it. So by default, the government is requiring you to put that information out if you're a government employee.
In fairness, the government also is trying to get some economies of scale and that similar stuff. Military personnel are a little notorious for spending like drunken sailors sometimes, and so they're hoping to protect their people by channeling that. But your point is very well taken.
So basically, we've lost the constitutional protections because of a runaround.
Well, there is no right of privacy in the Constitution. It has been found in the penumbras of all the other things.
So. Question.
Question.
What about a third party? When a third party does go to somebody like Equifax and acquires information, what sort of liability can he incur on his accuracy if he executes something that was inaccurate, does something based on information that is inaccurate?
So the third party goes to Equifax, gets a report, based on the contents of that report, takes an action. You're asking the third party's liable.
Is there a third party liability incur, and should we look to find third party reliability so that people who do execute based on this information has some sort of repercussion?
Well, I think the people that execute on it would have the liability if they did something wrong. The question I'd have is whether Equifax has any liability for giving them the wrong information.
Not being a lawyer, a citizen, I would say anybody in that chain should be held liable. I mean, I don't remember the exact terms for lawyer friends have told me, but I would think that if you're fool enough to buy information from an untrusted fool, that fool and also you should
Well, there's an element of, if Equifax says, here's what we've got, it may be right, maybe wrong, use it at your own risk, then the fool takes it as gospel truth. I mean, Equifax can protect itself by doing something like that. And I'm sure they do.
You must listen to a fool in the first place to get the bad information.
Well, say a situation I can imagine, say you go apply for a job somewhere or they run a credit report on you. A lot of times they do. You give them permission to do it by your application.
You have no choice.
Yeah, right. If you want that job,
you don't have to apply for the job.
Yeah, you just apply for the job.
Response.
And the information they give is wrong, and you get you don't get the job, or you get fired. You've been hired provisionally, and then they find out that you bounce checks or something like that. But it's wrong. Well, there just isn't that much liability because of the way that we have limited the country has limited the liability. They can, you have a right perhaps under federal statutes to get that information corrected or to put in a notice saying that you disagree with it and under the Fair Debt Reporting Act, or Fair Credit Reporting Act. But as far they have statutes that actually limit the liability to say you can't be. Right. Yeah.
It just seems that we're collapsing the cycle of what those laws were written under. Those were laws written under the Merchants of the Credit Unions in the 50s and 60s, and the early collection of the data, which I'm vaguely familiar with. Now, what they were doing in to get a credit report done in those days would take 15, 14 days. Now it's
you know, hit the button and, you know, one spits out in
seconds.
Mm-hmm. Seconds. And yeah. And the scope of information that's being collected is probably several exponents.
The interesting thing for me about your question is the extent to which the third party knows or should know that the information is wrong. You know, if they come to you, let's say you're employed and they're coming to you and saying, hey, we've ran a credit report and you've been bouncing checks, and you go, no, that's the guy next door with the same name as me, and there is a guy next door with the same name as you who does bounce checks. Yeah. At what point does the employer have to follow up, and at what point, you know, if you bring the employer police reports and all the stuff you've done to just clear your name, and they go ahead and fire you anyways for being the check bouncer, there might be some liability there because they're being reckless as to the truth. But if it's not just an extreme example like the one I just made up, you know, if there is something legitimate, legitimate room for error in there. Of course, it's hard to impose liability on somebody in a situation where they're acting on the best information they have, but it just happens to be bad information.
And you have to factor into it, you know, number of states in this country, most of them maybe, they're at-will employees. They can fire you for any reason, no reason, a bad reason, so long as it's not a prohibited reason. And firing you for bad credit report is not a protected group. You know, can't do it for age or sex, race, national origin, maybe gender in some states, sexual orientation.
And gender too.
No, gender too, right? Gender nationally, their response is, "We can fire if you want to." You know, we got bad information. Okay, he's wrong. Sorry.
Yeah, your tunnels are too long. You're fired. Yeah. And as long as it's not a pretext, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And the smart companies don't tell you why they fired you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, best practices are, you're out the door. Have a nice day. Yeah. No.
Sorry, it didn't work out.
Yeah.
The thing that it comes up against, I guess, is to put in those kind of restrictions, you know, to get the laws changed, to have more teeth in the Fair Credit Reporting Act or Fair Debt Collection Act or whatever, all the applicable ones, they give the FTC more authority, you run up against, well, this is going to hurt business, this is going to hurt commerce. And to require, you know, the we've got changes now where you have to, the credit reporting agencies have to let you see your credit report. I mean, that's new. They used to have to charge you for it, but they now actually have to let you see it, so you can possibly correct errors. I mean, we're making baby steps towards more protection for the individual. But to do some of the things that we might like to give the kind of broad protections, you know, you can't collect some of this data, would shut down a lot of what we do, the way the economy works, and it might have an impact on things that we like. You know, it's not just the big corporations fight it and are opposed to it, but also there's some things that do that are beneficial that he's going to tell you all about now.
Yeah, it's kind of a discovery of that now. Any questions? Yeah, go for it. Oh, let's get the mic to you actually first.
Follow up on correcting information in the credit reports. If you get the free credit report and don't fix something in it, does that support the accuracy of the data?
Or your
failure to correct it when you saw it was incorrect?
I would use it if I were cross-examining you. You know, I'd say, "Well, didn't you get the credit report and such, and what did you do about it? You didn't do anything about it? You didn't send him a letter? You didn't click on this link to send?" You know, yeah, I'd use that.
I mean, knowing it's wrong and leaving it there is an agreement, or is a decision on your part that it's close enough.
It's negligent.
Okay. Yeah, and for you to come back and say, "Well, now that it's hurt me, I want to fix it." Well, that's the risk you ran when you didn't fix it in the first place.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I actually have a. You know, they say we can get 3 free credit reports free or 1 for each bureau unless you forgot your password for, I think it's TransUnion, and then they lock your account and there's absolutely no one to call or contact to correct this. So then I guess you can't get...
That's why you use this password password for all your accounts, and then you don't have any trouble whatsoever.
Yes, please.
I use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
But when I'm being tricky, I go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I have so many passwords. I keep an encrypted file, text file, PGP encrypted, with all my passwords that I have to open every damn day to get onto any site, because I don't trust any of these password, you know, managers and stuff, because I can't remember them all, and I try to use all these unique. It's horrible. There really needs to be a better system.
Oh, there is. I'll put it on notes.
Okay.
There's been a lot of focus on things like government open source information collecting and the credit unions, but what about the things we can't imagine? When all of this stuff is in a database, and given the way computers are developing, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you can do with this information that we really can't just think of, you know, that the sum of the parts is greater than, you know. So I'd be interested if anyone knows anything about that as far as...
What exactly are you, I mean...
Well, as in, you get all this information in a huge database, what people can do with it, yeah, that's kind of scary, but what happens when we, you know, throw in some rudimentary artificial intelligence and we start using, you know, Bayesian systems to, you know, get trends and actually really identify people...
I think we're getting to that point where you know we'll log on to your computer and it'll say, "Hello, Dave. You know, did you like that meal you had yesterday at such and such?" You know, it's going to be freaky because.
Well, Jenny is 0.7 miles away.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, man. See now, maybe it's trying to change you.
It's one of those switchers. You know, that, you know. Depends on who's running it.
Isn't that kind of like Minority Report, where everywhere he goes, it knows where he is, and all the ads come up personal to him every display he walks past?
We're getting that now. I mean, they want to do cell phone tracking. You know, you have GPS on it, and you go to the grocery store, and you know, it'll know that you're there, and you'll see they have the ads that now can appear. I haven't seen it yet that can appear just to you, or sound that is directed. They can direct it so it just goes to one little spot. So you'll be walking by, you know, the cereal, and it'll go, you know, "Have you tried new Fruity Pebbles? They're even better than, you know." And it's like, what? You know, it's very spooky. But it's the motivation, and the driving force behind it is money. You know, if they can target and tailor the ads to, you know, specifically.
Go back to your issue about the passwords, this is when I teach a class on intro to information security at Georgia Tech, this is one of the programs we talk about. It's called KeePass. It's open source. It's free. It runs on virtually every platform. I wouldn't be surprised we could get a client for this wireless mic. It's AES encrypted. You use one passphrase and you encrypt all your stuff. I highly recommend, though, if you are doing this for work and home, you can have as many databases of passwords as you want. I recommend you keep a separate one for your work passwords from your home passwords, because if you get hit by a bus and they say, "We need the root password to whatever," they're going to ask you for the master password and you just gave them all your bank account information. You can put notes in this. I highly recommend you use this.
Going back to the question I was asked, my wife and I both use one computer on one Amazon account, and we confuse the living daylights out of that thing. Because you know, it'll try to hand me Neal Stephenson, and then it'll try to hand me knitting books, and one of those is a good hit, one of those is not. Well, actually, the knitting is kind of fun. But we're already starting to do that. And the intelligence agencies and the military are also trying to run those correlations on people. I think the anti-terror efforts and the anti-insurgency efforts in Iraq, there was a great deal of trying to build networks network maps of people and trying to figure out how they were interrelated based on very limited data. So I think it's definitely coming, and the question is going to be, how reliable is it going to be? For us, we'll ever get to the point where it's actually admissible in evidence, which is a high but not terribly high bar, and then just in general, if Bob C is a serial killer based on his serial preferences and the books he reads and the fact that his shoe size is, you know, 17E. Well, are people going to accept that? Are people going to go, that doesn't sound quite right?
Well, that leads to the question, if that's enough to actually possibly get a warrant or open an investigation, but somebody's going to have to put boots on the ground and actually collect hard evidence, wouldn't they?
I think I can see this actually being, if there's a very high probability of accuracy, if you have some concrete stuff that really ties together, you know, magazine and book subscriptions and purchases and some actual data that seems rationally related to a crime, I can see it being enough for a warrant.
Probable cause.
Right. I mean, the database itself would have to be to a level where it was where it was reasonably reliable.
Reasonably reliable.
Yes. I'm a lawyer. I talk in words like that.
No, but I mean, that what does that mean? It's
a newfangled arguable reasonable.
You know, probable cause isn't much, you know, for depending on the circumstance. I mean, it's.
I mean, an officer can do a stop and frisk based on. Yeah. I looked at them and these three things: gait, they looked back at me too long, and you know, seemed a little disheveled. That's enough. Stop and frisk. Yeah.
Well, you need for a weapon frisk.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. For your safety.
But I mean, going back to
whether they can seize it, that's different.
It's
way off topic. To seize it, my understanding is they have to be able to suspect that you're armed and dangerous, not just armed. But that's a different topic.
Well, there's the corollary to the database problem. Oh yeah, hold on. Let him ask a question.
So how can they tell the difference between if someone's buying magazines and books and looking up sites? How can they tell if they're trying to learn how to be a serial killer or if they're trying to learn what serial killers think like to avoid being murdered?
I read I don't know if y'all watch Castle with Nathan Fillion, so of course you do. But they did that. They were tracking a serial killer and they pulled up magazine subscriptions, and Castle, who's a murder writer, goes, I get about half of these. And the FBI agent says, yeah, you kill people for a living in your books. and that was, it's going to be something like that where if they get, say, Popular Science because they're smart, most serial killers are smart, and they get Forensics Monthly because they're interested in hiding things, and they get Animal Cruelty Monthly because, you know, most serial killers do torture animals. That's starting to actually build something that we can all take to a judge and say, you know, there might be something here. If they get Martha Stewart living, That would decrease that wouldn't, because most circles aren't so married. But that would tend to decrease the reliability of that correlation. And so it would have to be something that you'd take to a judge and it would pass the smell test.
Of course, the smart serial killer would then, you know, beware of that profiling type of thing and start subscribing to things like that to try to throw off the scent. The question that I think comes up, I don't know, I'm reading a book on how to be a serial killer. I haven't seen too many of those, but bomb making. You know, you get offers of bomb-making information off the internet, all kind of, and I've been curious about reading it. I never have done so because I don't want to. I mean, I'm sure there are millions of people do it every year, so it's a big database. But I don't want to get in that database. I don't want to have them look and see, you know, that I read how to make a pipe bomb. Used to, you could buy the Anarchist Cookbook, in a bookstore. You can pay cash. You know, the good old way. You know, get the paperback copy.
The camera still got your picture.
Well, I mean, I had a camera. You know, this is 20, 30 years ago that you could buy something like that, you know, how to make a bomb. These days, you know, there's some things that I taught a media law course at D.C. a number of years ago and did things, covered obscenity. And back then I didn't get a lot of things off the internet. I got some books. I got Robert Mapplethorpe's, you know, photographs. He did these very provocative photographs that were ruled obscene in a number of jurisdictions. But I always wanted to keep it real close to my notes for media law, so I could, you know, if everybody ever stopped me or came by my house, police, I teach a course. That's why I have it. I don't have it, you know, for other purposes. Don't, you know. But I don't know if I'd do it today off the internet. I don't know.
And the ability to pull out the signal from the noise of, you know, all of your purchases over time will be kind of interesting, too. I'm not sure how well that's advanced or developed, but you're going to have some technically savvy judges and lawyers before this thing really gets settled. And that's at least 20 years off because... Yeah. I'm about 30, and I'm really the first generation of who you can expect a lawyer to know what they're doing. And judges are going to be 50, 60 before they're actually on the bench, by and large. So it's going to be many years before this really gets settled.
Yeah. I'm over 50, but I was a computer science minor in college back, you know, pre personal computing, or they had the Apple.
Punch cards?
Yeah. Oh, I did punch cards. You know, Fortran, you know, but so I'm a little ahead of my generation, I guess. It's amazing to me the number of my peers who age-wise that don't, you know, I can't do this. Fix this for me, Paul.
A lawyer I worked for, honest to goodness, would not let me do a massive spreadsheet on securities transactions for a client in Excel. It had to be in a Word chart because he couldn't handle Excel. I mean, and you know, he's about Paul's age, so that's what we're working with right now. It'll get better, but yeah. That's what we're working with right now.
Well, you said signal to noise, and that's part of the reason why I'm here in a way. But I was along punch cards, paper tape. You know, his age, I was more stayed in the computer science end of things. But in my environment, we're pursuing. Because of the nature of our problems in our environment and the scale, I'm high performance compute, and we are pursuing real-time sample monitoring of the environment for characteristics of real-time traffic and analysis. And basically, we're looking at, you know, at sources being individual servers and their behavior and individual applications on those servers performing real-time. But the reason I'm wondered in here is that that also is where I see, because we're pursuing technology out of the high end of traffic sniffing and scooping traffic real time on the internet, the same tools we're looking at are the high end tools found in that environment, and we'll be looking for not at your data, what's stored on disk and out of credit unions, but the data that will be next attacked will be the data coming off your PDA as of this moment. Every packet and keep alive, every little sink of your PDA, you know, every one of those packets is going to be soon used to characterize you and the device that you have in your pocket right now. You know, and it's really amazing how much of that traffic I've only... Because of my knowledge of other traffics and traffic stuff, how much of that traffic is in the clear?
You know, sure. Yeah.
You know, it's just, and people don't realize. I mean, it's just been known for a long time that every mail relay your mail goes through, your mail is storing forward, guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only are you exposed at Google, you're exposed at everywhere between here and there. So the exposure of your traffic and your confidential data, and it's going to go real time. You know, it's the best way to phrase it.
For lawyers, for a while there was there were these ethical opinions about whether you could talk on a cell phone to a client, whether you could send email to a client, because we have a, you know, ethical duty to preserve the confidences of clients, and the technology didn't change, but the fact that everybody was doing it caused them to say, well, okay, yeah, it's okay. You can talk on them. You got to tell them you're doing it. Yeah, but other than that, you can talk on a cell phone or send them an email. You know, it doesn't have to be encrypted. Well, like I said, technology hadn't changed. It's still, you know, snoopable. But because, you know, it's sort of like people using cell phones, I guess, in driving. You know, everybody's doing it. They need to fix the make the law match the action, to make the activities. So we're just keeping our fingers crossed and assuming that it's not, you know, being made public.
And at least in a lot of cases I work on, with producing emails, there's a very high there's so many emails to be produced because they're all kept, as opposed to letters, a lot of which get thrown away, that you just kind of assume at some point something privileged is going to go to the opposing counsel in an email production. And so now there's what's called clawback provisions.
Yeah.
It used to be you produced that letter, you were screwed. You just broke the privilege and it's gone.
Yeah.
Now it's like, oh, whoops, I want that back. And you preserve the privilege.
There's a little blurb in the bottom of all lawyers' emails usually. It says, this email may be privileged and confidential and you shouldn't be reading it. And if you are reading it, you're not supposed to be reading it. Give it back, destroy it. It doesn't count. Take back. And I guess there have been cases that have required that or set, are founded that didn't have it, and so that it may have waived the privilege. If you waive the privilege by making a mistake, that the other side can get access to it and can use it against you. And that I guess goes to the clawback idea of being able to get it back. But once the bell has been rung, you can't if you disclose something. Because it's a lot of difficulty. You'd have to go and explain to them what PGP is. And I mean, I've thought about that. I have a steady client I do a lot of business with. I probably should encrypt it. And it's a lot of laziness, inertia,
And if you get in litigation, they're entitled to look at correspondence relating to the issue. And so let's say you own a Subway franchise and you're suing the franchisor. And franchisor says, I want all correspondence related to this dispute. You can't hand him a stack of encrypted correspondence. Here, good luck. You got to give it to him in the clear, at which point you run into the same problem. That'd be really funny, though.
The thing that's interesting is everybody, just judging by the questions here today, everybody's paranoid about the credit reporting agencies having this big database. Well, they really go to some lengths to try to ensure that that data is secure and that they're the only people inputting information. Yeah. How about your Facebook page? How about Twitter? You saw the wall of sheep. There's people giving away their user IDs and passwords. That means if somebody here were to get a laptop, log into your Facebook page from the same IP address you just logged into, post pictures that they fabricated with GIMP while here at the con, or pictures they took of you walking around the con that look compromising but really aren't because you weren't there and didn't see the context, they can deliberately pollute your profile out there that is being used when they do this data mining. How many of you, people have this tinfoil hat on when it comes to the credit reporting agency, when your own worst enemy is you and how you actually manage your access to the information you give out on the net?
Of course, I don't know how I agree that it's a theoretical possibility, and actually at DragonCon there might be some guy in a couple of hotel rooms deliberately doing that. I could see that. I can envision that. But the credit reporting agencies, the people that have a financial interest are more likely to do stuff. They're more likely to use the information than somebody that just wants to hassle with you.
Well, you mean like if I were a really large medical company who potentially could lose $80 million in a suit, but if I make you look like a loon, I wouldn't lose my suit, so I hire somebody to do that to you?
That's a John Grisham novel there.
that's a very high-risk, high-reward strategy. And,
that's true, too.
Yeah, there's never been anything like the Watergate or anything like that. They've never done anything like that in the past. See, that's the thing. Is it a reasonable expectation of paranoia? And that's the question is, there is some reasonable expectation of paranoia. People do evil things, and we've made the barrier for doing potentially very evil things to individuals or even whole groups of individuals very low. And so what's the probability of that actually happening? Now, mind you, there's how many people are on the internet right now? Hundreds of millions. The probability of happening to you as an individual is pretty low, but then again, it depends who you tick off.
Yeah, this is one of the
4chan, for instance.
Yeah, talking about one of the benefits. I was wondering, what about what we were talking about earlier? Is throwing it all open, and if you want to collect where I am every 30 seconds on a cell phone packet, okay. And when your jealous ex-girlfriend posts that you're at the strip joint and alerts your wife to it, and you can say, well, look at my cell phone packets. I wasn't there. This is just malicious. So there is some question of why don't you flood out your information so that the anomalous bad actions do become noise as opposed to good data.
Well, actually, I don't expect to be able to explain to my wife that I really wasn't there based on the GPS information, because a lot of people have the same attitude as that guy who says, you can't use Excel, it's got to be... No, I create the table in Excel and paste it into Word, and he's okay with it, right? Well, that same barrier exists to the vast majority of people who aren't here at the con. So what's the expectation that anybody would accept your input as nothing more than technobabble trying to get out of you were at the strip joint? Well,
there's a search for the guy who posts everything he does every day on the internet. There's a guy that takes a picture of himself every 30 seconds or something and posts it, where he is, what he's doing.
He's like an MIT guy. He wears a rig that records everything.
Well, the one I'm talking about also has an Arabic name, and so somebody somebody.
It's a book called Versus, and it talks about predictive analytics on people's behavior.
You can talk to that one in the microphone. You're not talking about your... No. Oh, God. This guy does work for one.
It talks about predictive analytics on people's behavior and how, in his case, he got targeted by Homeland Security.
Mm, okay.
He didn't fit any kind of normal pattern of behavior, but he was an artist. And so he was always traveling, and that was part of his art form. So he threw the door open, and he said, let's go ahead. I'll show my whole life. Every meal I take a picture of it. Every toilet I use, I take a picture of it.
Yep. Yeah, my wife's 79-year-old grandmother got pulled aside by Homeland Security because they're looking at her passport. She travels a lot. She'd been to Russia and to Israel and to a couple other places. They were like, "What are you doing? These are all hot spots."
That's the approach of throwing everything open. I mean, I think that's actually going to be our future. I think that we're all going to be at a point where we carry along a little recorder that is constantly going. When they can store that information, and you'll want it. You'll want to have that. Everybody, it'll be the norm, so that you can go, oh, what was I going to do this morning? To go to a 10:15 to 10:30 and read what I said. You know, and then that's right, I was supposed to pick up bread at the grocery store. In fact, I think that's going to be the norm, that if you don't do that, you're going to be flagging yourself as, well, you know, why can't you tell us where you were last night or 3 weeks ago at 7 o'clock? Where's your data thingy, whatever it is?
It's guilty till proven innocent.
Yeah. Well, and the culture may change. I lived in New York for a couple of years, and you get on the subway, and you don't look at other people. They don't exist until you get off the subway. And that's just the culture of New York, and any city that's got a major mass transit like that. And it may be the point where, yes, you know it's out there, but you just don't look because it's incredibly rude. That may be where we're going, yeah.
So the downside I could see with that, especially if you get to a criminal proceeding, is you have the right to not testify or incriminate yourself, yet if you have these external documents, mm-hmm. not yourself, those can be obtained. It's similar to, do you keep your email in Gmail? They only need a subpoena, but if you have an email server in your house, the barrier is a lot higher to get at your stuff because it's your house, it's your papers and effects. But if it's on Gmail, it's not. So why would you...
Well, they may not be able to get... I mean, if it's your personal data thing, I'm not a criminal lawyer, and I can't... I don't know all of the ins and outs of the, right against self-incrimination. There's some things they can and can't get, some things that are treated as coming from you. So it's possible that they might not be able to get it without your permission. But it'd be one of those things... Because maybe it's encrypted. You know, you maintain it, it's encrypted. You don't have to give them the password. But it's going to be one of those things where you have a criminal trial and the defendant doesn't testify, and the judge will say, they have the right of, that's their right, and have whatever jury admonition they give. But the jury's still thinking, why didn't that guy get up there and say anything? You know, it makes you, it's tough for them to overcome that. Well, it's going to be the same thing with, they won't be able to comment on the fact that you didn't show your video of where you are every minute of the day. But the jury will be thinking, well, why didn't that guy, we all carry these things around that record everything. What's his problem? Why didn't he do it? It must be that something on there he didn't want to see. In fact, it'd probably be worse than it is right now with just not testifying. It'll be not being able to prove it, So you must be guilty.
Yeah, I can prove I didn't commit that murder because I was buying drugs on the corner. Here's the video. Yeah. That's why it won't show the video.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done any criminal work, but I've heard stories of my client is a complete idiot, and if he gets on the stand, he will shoot his mouth off and, insult the judge's mother. So you don't put him up because he's an idiot, not because he did, not because he didn't do it, not because he did it and didn't want to say anything about it. But I also, I observed a case, a capital case, where the, definitely a case, where the defendant had been writing little songs in jail about how he's going to get off on this charge and go and kill people again. And he mailed that out, and you, of course, your mail gets searched in prison, and that was admissible. So, yeah, having your brain hooked on is kind of a nice thing to do.
We were fortunate that most, the majority of criminals probably aren't the brightest people in the world. That's the big saving grace for society, is that. But here or there.
Okay, that's Keith's fault.
The problem isn't that the criminals aren't smart. It's just the criminals that have been put away aren't smart.
Well, but the, you know, the police do this for 20 years, and so they get some experience. And the criminals usually do get caught fairly quickly. They don't get to build the experience. And you do have some people who are smart enough to not get caught.
Yeah, but then we send them to crime university called the prison system.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, those are usually the white collar guys. It seems that violent crime typically gets found out.
Violent crime gets found very quickly. There's also a more societal incentive to prosecute that. You know, if you're not Enron, you might get prosecuted, but they're not going to go after you like if you murder somebody. If you are Enron.
You know, Eric Schmidt, I don't know if you heard his quote about, I'm thinking about back to, you know, having everything, your life an open book. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was quoted by, or was actually interviewed by, was it MSNBC or some? Anyway, but he said, basically his response was about, you know, Google getting all this information, all this, collecting all this information on people, and what privacy implications that had. He said, you know, if you're doing something that you don't want to be known, you shouldn't be doing it. And the problem that I've got, the libertarian streak again, is everybody does something that, you know, they don't want to be known. You know, and maybe something you don't even realize you're doing. There was a community in New York that they started looking at Google Earth to find in their community to find people who had swimming pools in their backyards who hadn't registered them with the city, so that they could, you know, make them pay up, because apparently I'll have to be registered and pay a fee every year, and it's like $70,000 of additional income for the small community. It wasn't a real big place. Actually, it must have been affluent, I guess, if they had that many swimming pools. But there's an example of somebody doing something that they may not even realize they were doing something they shouldn't have been doing in Schmidt's formula. And that's the thing I worry about, is there are all sorts of things that we may do that we just would not prefer not to be broadcast or be brought up on, you know, have somebody question it, because it's, you know, they don't like, you know, what it is. We're all criminals, I had a professor in law school say. Every one of you is a criminal. Everybody in this room is a criminal. And his point was, or maybe her point was, that we all break laws. There are so many laws out there, we all break them. And so, you know, you can't really, you have different degrees of criminality, I suppose, broken down, but we all do things that, you know, are a violation of law. We talk on the cell phone when we're not supposed to when driving in states that don't permit it, or we speed, we don't, you know, all sorts of things like that.
I have insurance through Progressive, and they have a little thing that they will send you to put into your car's diagnostic port that will track where you are, how fast you're driving, things like that. And then after they've done that for 6 months, they will lower your policy by 25% or raise your policy by 25% based on how good of a driver you are. So I think the opposite is true as well of what you just said, is that is a deterrent for me to break that law of going 2 or 3 miles an hour over the speed limit, because I know that Progressive in a couple of months is going to raise my rate. So knowing that somebody's watching that behavior deters me from making bad decisions as well.
Somebody in, I think it was New York, rented a car from Hertz or Avis or whoever that had a GPS in it, and they tracked him over this weekend, and they found out he had to go that distance that amount of time. He had been going 85 miles an hour. He's obviously speeding, and I don't remember if they
fined him or just
yeah, they did something yeah. That, you know, it's all in the contract, and I think the court threw it out when he litigated it. Yeah. But I mean, that's the other interesting question right now is, will a court uphold a situation, you know, something like that, where, you know, if you say, you know, screw you, Progressive, I'm not doing this. This is Big Brother. How's it actually going to fall out if you take it to court?
It's voluntary.
But it'd be voluntary, yeah.
Yeah. Here's a question I have when you start talking about that. If I were representing Progressive, say you do that for 6 months, you know, and you're very careful with your driving, and then you take that gizmo out, you get the lower rates, you go back to your normal habits, and, you know, there's testimony, you get involved in an accident, there's testimony that you were exceeding the speed limit. You know, what is Progressive's, you know, do they have any claim to say, wait a minute, this guy committed fraud by pretending that he was a really safe driver and, you know, and submitting this data to us so we'd give him a break on his insurance, when in fact, you know, you maybe have several speeding tickets or, you know, something in that the interim afterwards. I'd be a little leery of that. I think you need to drive carefully from now on.
And the honest question is, can you say, well, Progressive has ranked me as a safe driver 10 years in a row. This claim that I was driving unsafely, that can't be right. Look at all this previous history. It's hearsay. That'd be a problem in itself.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
I work in the e-discovery business, so we work for a lot of law firms and lawyers all over across the country and some of them across the world. I would disagree with your earlier statement about the rate of change within the legal industry, because I have met some 60 and 70-year-old lawyers who are very progressive, mm-hmm. and they have me do search term sets over and over again. And I've also met some individuals who are very young and who are very much like Congress, and they don't get anything done. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think the rate of change overall for the industry is going up, such to the point that the law firms that are not more responsive to the judicial system are the ones that are going to get hit harder and harder with fines.
Well, so, if I can ask, though, older attorneys, do they understand what they're doing? You really, you know, grok it, to use a term that we'll all get. Or do they kind of, they understand it well enough to work with it, but they don't get it?
They don't have to get it. They just have to produce 3.5 million pages by Thursday.
Right.
You know, they're just going to do whatever it takes to get it done.
Yeah. To clarify, because I think you do make a good point. A lot of lawyers have recognized this issue and are educating themselves as quickly as they can. But, you know, the younger people in the room, and I'm going to count myself in that group, just understand computers much more instinctively than the older people. To some extent, if you grew up with it.
You understand the high level, not the low level.
Right, right.
There's a lot of the stuff that's
right
underneath it that you're taking for granted.
Exactly. No, but what I'm trying to say is somebody who grew up from 12 years old on the computer is going to be more comfortable with how they work.
The difference between using it and understanding.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's but the comfort level, though, is key. I mean, it is an important thing that they don't. I deal with people that just throw up their hands and say, oh, it's a computer. I don't, you know, it's all a mystery. It's a black box mystery. The younger folks may not understand what's actually going on inside the machine, but they don't have that intimidation of, oh, it's a thing that they use.
And they do have a feel for how programmers think best practices should work. So they know where to look a lot of the time. Even though they don't know what the actual answer is, they have a clue.
Well, the issue that I have, you know, as somebody that did programming back in the ancient days, is with some of the higher level languages, you don't know, and the scripting and all the things, you don't know, you know, a computer goes and looks in this location, gets this address, pulls this byte, puts this byte in this thing, goes to this address, hits this byte, takes this byte, does, you know, I can't even remember all that terms, XORs or whatever, does something to them, gets another byte, does, you know, they don't get a grasp of how the basic, you know, assembly level type of computing goes on, so they don't understand exactly what it is doing. That part, I think, is lost, or maybe lost today to some of the younger folks that, you know, like I said, use higher level things. But as far as the comfort level, I think is the key thing for my daughter would not be intimidated by, you know, things that go on a computer, because she just wouldn't think about it as being this mysterious magic machine. It's just it's a tool. It's the thing.
I do think that you and Keith and others who worked in computers a lot have that same level of comfort just because the amount of time you spent with them. Not to say that if you're old, you know nothing. If you're old, by and large, you just haven't interacted with them enough to know anything.
Well, I was the kid who took everything apart.
Mm-hmm. And those folks will still be, you know, they're a small group of folks that do that, you know, take everything apart.
Yeah, speaking of which, you get some surprises. The guy who lives down the block from me, he's a good 10, 15 years older than me. And I'm Vietnam era, so I'm kind of old. And he had a networking problem, so I went over to his house and I started working on his network. And he started asking me really intelligent questions. So that's how does that work? That's a network mask. Now, what's that do? And I was mystified. I was like, how on earth would this? He's a ham radio operator.
No, okay.
He gets it.
Any other questions? I guess we'll clear out and let the next panel get going. So thank you all for coming up for your questions.